Egyptology from Brown University, his master's, in Egyptology from Brown University, and in 1991, his PhD in Egyptology from the same university. He is married to Marie Patricia Thomas of Providence, Rhode Island, where they now reside with their two children, Rachel 3 and Jacob 2. Despite what the program says, we do have a respondent, and that is, if you want to introduce yourself.
Stephen Epperson.
Okay. And that's a last-minute addition. What we'll do is go through the presentation. There are some slides. I'll be turning off part of the lights during the presentation. We'll give the respondent time, and then if there's time for questions, we'll get to those at the end. And thank you for letting me know that I was speaking to a dead mic. Thompson.
Before I begin, I guess I should make two comments, editorial comments or whatever. I just used this before. I don't know, does anybody remember the old Federal Express commercials that had the guy that could talk, you know, really, really fast? I can do better than that. But that doesn't mean I want to. I'm going to try and read this as slowly as possible. But if I start, I will start to speed up as I go. And if I get too fast, if someone wants to raise a hand or call me on it, I will try and slow down again. That's something I've always had a problem with in giving presentations. It's not that I'm trying to hurry through the material. It's not like I don't have enough time to give what I have. It's just a nervous habit. I guess I was born with it. And secondly, my slides are of differing qualities. Some a bishop I served with took for me, and some I took myself. And you can probably figure out which ones I took myself. So I did the best I can, and hopefully they will be somewhat visible. And with that, I guess if we could have some lights, and I'll get going. Okay. In the entry on the facsimiles from the Book of Abraham in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, we are told that the prophet's explanations of each of the facsimiles accord with present understanding of Egyptian religious practice. This is a truly remarkable statement in view of the fact that those Egyptologists who have commented on Joseph's interpretations of the facsimiles have stated emphatically that his interpretations are not correct from the perspective of the Egyptologist who attempts to interpret Egyptian religious literature and iconography as he or she believes the ancient Egyptians themselves would have. For example, in the famous pamphlet compiled by the Reverend Spalding in 1912, James H. Breasted, the first person to hold a chair in Egyptology in America, stated that Joseph Smith's interpretation of the facsimiles very clearly demonstrates that he was totally unacquainted with the significance of these documents and absolutely ignorant of the simplest facts of Egyptian writing and civilization. More recently, Klaus Baer, speaking of Joseph Smith's interpretations of the original facsimile 1 and the accompanying text, noted that the Egyptologist interprets it differently, relying on a considerable body of parallel data, research, and knowledge. The matter which I propose to address is whether or not the present understanding of Egyptian religious practice supports the explanations of the facsimiles found in the Book of Abraham. In addition, I will examine the contribution which I think a study of Egyptian history can make to our understanding of the nature of the Book of Abraham. To begin, let us first look at facsimiles 1 and 3 of the Book of Abraham. A correct understanding of the original context and purpose of these scenes has been made possible by the recovery of the Joseph Smith papyri from the files of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in 1967. Within this group of papyri are found the original from which facsimile number 1 was derived. A study of the papyri shows that papyrus Joseph Smith 1 was originally a vignette belonging to an Egyptian funerary text known as the First Book of Breathings, dating to the 1st century BC, portions of which are also among the papyri recovered by the church. A comparison of the material found in some of the Kirtland papers with papyrus Joseph Smith 1 and 11 indicates that the scene was in approximately this shape when Joseph Smith received it, and that the missing portions were restored when facsimile number 1 was created. Ed Ashman has carried out a detailed study of papyrus Joseph Smith 1, and he's restored it like this. This will probably be familiar to you from his Sunstone article, which appeared in 1979. I believe this restoration to be largely correct, other than the empty hand of Anubis. And by that I mean this hand right here. In my brief experience studying such scenes, and just, no, I actually haven't studied them, just recognized them, seen them as I've been going through Egyptian literature and text, I've never seen a scene like that where the Anubis figure has his hand just kind of hanging out there, waving in the air. He has something in it. And in most instances, when he has one hand out and one hand down, the question is, where's his other hand? That's a question that I have yet to resolve, given the quality of material available to me. I want to put something in his hand, and that would be what I call a new jar. Okay, and here's a scene. Let me get some focus here. That's as good as it's going to get, I guess. A new jar, and even out of focus, I think. What I need here by this little jar in his hand. That would be a container of oil. You can't see anything there. That's a similar scene from Hibbus Temple, but it's just not visible given the quality of the slide and the lighting that we have. So it is also very probable that facsimile number 3 served as the concluding vignette of this same text. This conclusion is based on the fact that the name of the individual for whom this particular copy of the Book of Breathings was prepared occurs as Horus in both Papyrus Joseph Smith number 1. Okay, and Horus is over here. By deceased. All pretty much the same thing. So it looks like these things were made for the same individual. Also, facsimile 3 and facsimile 1 are similar in size. And from Papyrus Joseph Smith 1, we can tell that the facsimiles were created roughly life-size, one-to-one scale. And also, similar scenes to this occur in other known copies of the first Book of Breathings. Note, for instance, this scene from a papyrus in Tübingen. Okay, this is P. Tübingen P2016 from the Roman period. There are some differences, but there are also some similarities. And this is the same type of text that we have in the Papyrus Joseph Smith relating to the Book of Breathings. The first Book of Breathings is an Egyptian funerary text whose earliest attestation is the end of the 30th Egyptian dynasty, around 340 BC. This text was buried with the deceased and was intended to serve as a sort of passport and guide to achieving a blessed state in the hereafter. This involved the continued existence of the deceased in the company of Osiris, king of the netherworld, and with the sun god Re in his celestial bark. As a first step in achieving these goals, the deceased had to undergo the proper rituals of mummification. Papyrus Joseph Smith 1, okay, you'll see this a couple more times, I guess, is a depiction of the god Anubis, figure standing over here, officiating in the embalming rites of the deceased individual, Horus, the one lying on the bier. That's where the name that we just looked at. This scene is not a depiction of a sacrifice of any sort. To note just a few instances in which Joseph Smith's interpretations of these figures differ from the way that they are to be understood in their original context, figure 11, which Joseph Smith interprets as designed to represent the pillars of heaven. These are these little things down here. They go all the way across. Is actually a palace facade called a serek, which was a frequent decoration on funerary objects. The serek originally depicted the front of a fortified palace with its narrow gateway, floral tracery above the gates, clerestories, and recessed buttresses. Figure 12, which Joseph interpreted as Ra Kiang, and this stuff here, Ra Kiang is a transliteration of a Hebrew word for the firmament, signifying expanse or firmament over our heads, but in this case, in relation to this subject, the Egyptians meant it to signify Shamal, which is a Hebrew word, not an Egyptian, to be high or the heavens, answering to the Hebrew word Shamayim. Actually, these strokes represent the water in which the crocodile, this figure here, representing the god Horus, swims. Although it appears that the water is supported by the palace facade, it looks like this is the base right here, and the water's on top, and then you've got the guy standing on the water, which is kind of a remarkable scene. Anubis walking on the water. I don't know. I never thought about it that way. But it looks like everything is stacked one on top of the other. But this is an illusion produced by the perspective of Egyptian art. Actually, everything shown above the facade is to be understood as occurring behind it. Okay. So figure 11, the pillars of heaven, represents the wall surrounding the place which all this stuff took place. So the next thing, so take everything and kind of set it back as you go up. So first you'd see the wall, then there's the water, then presumably there's some land on which this whole scene is taking place. So you have to stretch it out that way. The Egyptians didn't have perspective such as we conceive of it, or they just had a different perspective in their art. Klaus Bayer has described facsimile 3 as a summary and one illustration of what the text promised. The deceased, after successfully undergoing judgment, is welcomed into the presence of Osiris. Facsimile 3 shows that the deceased, Horus, that might be completely off base, but that's what it seems to me to be. Behind Osiris stands his wife, Isis. Okay. In my opinion, none of these figures can be made to fit what Joseph Smith believed them to be. So if this is the way the ancient Egyptians would have interpreted the figures, how is it that the statement can be made that the prophet's explanations of each of the facsimiles accords with present understanding of Egyptian religious practice? First, it is of vital importance to note that the originals of these facsimiles of the Book of Abraham were created for a specific purpose, to provide for the successful transition to the afterlife of the deceased. Okay. While it is possible that some of these figures might appear in other contexts and take on other meanings in those contexts, in the context of funerary papyri, their interpretation is limited to funerary purposes. The approach taken in attempting to just support Joseph's interpretations of these figures is to compare them with figures found in other historical and textual contexts. It is simply not valid, however, to search through 3,000 years of Egyptian religious iconography in an attempt to find parallels which can be pushed, prodded, squeezed, or linked to attempt to justify Joseph's interpretations. For example, there has been an attempt to associate facsimile 1 with an Egyptian royal festival known as the Sed Festival, whose purpose was, quote, the symbolic renewing of the power of kingship. Nibley has claimed that in the Sed Festival, the king is ritually put to death and then restored to life. An important part of the Sed Festival was the choosing of a substitute to die for the king, so that he would not have to undergo the painful process to achieve resurrection. There are serious obstacles which render this comparison invalid. First, there is the element of time. The last known depiction of the Sed Festival dates to 690 to 664 BC. Remember, the papyrus Joseph Smith 1 was created around 100 BC. There is no evidence that the Sed Festival was celebrated during the Greco-Roman period, the time during which papyrus Joseph Smith 1 was created. It is important to note the context in which these supposed parallels occur. Scenes of the Sed Festival occurring in a private context, that is, on an object owned by a non-royal person, are extremely rare, and none occur in funerary papyri. Third, the so-called lion furniture scenes. Let's see how this came out. Yeah, a little better. Okay. The lion furniture scenes from the Sed Festival, this is what is referred to as a lion furniture scene. Okay, right here. Bear no resemblance to the scene in papyrus Joseph Smith 1. I mean, anybody can look at that and see that it doesn't look like what Joseph Smith 1 is. So even if the scene were derived from earlier depictions of the Sed Festival, finally, it should be noted that while earlier generations of Egyptologists thought that the Sed Festival involved the ritual murder of the king or his representative, more recent analysis has shown this not to be the case. There's no evidence that anyone was ever killed in conjunction with the Sed Festival. So even if the scene were derived from earlier depictions of the Sed Festival, it would still have nothing to do with the sacrifice of anyone. Nibley has compared facsimile 3 with scenes from 18th Dynasty, which is 1550 to 1295 BC, Egyptian tombs depicting the tomb owner in the presence of the king, since Joseph Smith claims that the scene shows Abraham reasoning upon the principles of astronomy in the king's court. The comparison of these two types of scenes runs into many of the same obstacles that were found in the attempt to equate facsimile 1 with Sed Festival scenes. There is a gap of over 1,000 years between the two types of scenes being compared. Nibley attempts to get around this by stating that this is a timeless scene, recognizable from pre-dynastic monuments on down to the latest times. Nibley cites no evidence which substantiates this claim. The work which Nibley relies on in making his comparison does not discuss any examples of such scenes from the period from which the Joseph Smith papyri derive. In fact, the scenes with which Nibley wishes to compare facsimile 3 are atypical when viewed from the perspective of the history of Egyptian tomb decoration. It is also significant that none of the type of scene with which Nibley wishes to compare facsimile 3 occurs in funerary papyri. The comparison of facsimile 3 to this type of scene is as spurious as that of facsimile 1 with Sed Festival scenes. In addition to invalidating comparisons made between the facsimiles and other genres of Egyptian texts, attention to the original context of the facsimiles also serves to settle an ongoing debate about whether or not the figure 3 in facsimile number 1, which is the sacrificing figure in facsimile number 1, the Anubis figure in papyrus Joseph Smith 1, originally held a knife. Before the discovery of the papyri, it was argued whether this knife was original or was added by Joseph Smith. With the discovery of the original facsimile 1, it became apparent that Joseph indeed was the source of the restoration of the knife, as demonstrated by Ashmint. There continue to be attempts, however, to argue that a knife was originally present based on accounts from individuals who saw the papyri in Kirtland or Nauvoo. The question never asked in arguments for the original presence of a knife is what would the knife have meant in its original funerary context? As stated earlier, facsimile number 1 represents the deceased individual, Horus, lying on a bier undergoing the rites of mummification by the god Anubis. Now, while part of the mummification process did involve evisceration, I am aware of no instance in which this procedure is depicted. Given the Egyptians' reticence in depicting things which might be harmful to the deceased in his tomb, it is unlikely that an Egyptian would ever wish himself depicted being approached by a god with a knife. Let's see how this slide came out. For example, Frequently in tomb decorations and inscriptions on sarcophagi, they would take the hieroglyphs consist of all sorts of little pictures of animals, of things, of people, what have you. And any of the little animals that were thought to be potentially dangerous to the deceased would be mutilated in the hieroglyph so they couldn't harm him. And for example, up there we have a snake, and his head is detached from his body.
This is the snake's body, and in normal hieroglyphic writing, the head would be attached. But because this is from a coffin, first intermediate period coffin, they've removed the head so that that snake can't harm the deceased who's buried in the coffin. In addition, they would there were certain weapons that the deceased would sometimes be buried with in order to help him protect himself from dangers in the afterworld. But these weapons would be broken, so they couldn't harm the deceased himself. He could use them, but they couldn't do him any harm. So I just don't see an Egyptian that would really like to have himself depicted being approached by someone with a knife, whoever it was. Knives are usually found in the hands of demons, protective deities such as Bes and Thoeris, who are the Egyptian god and goddess responsible for protecting women during childbirth, the doorkeepers in the afterworld, and the devourer in the scenes of the judgment of the dead. I know of no instance in which Anubis is depicted with a knife. The original context of facsimile 1 does not admit the possibility of a knife in Anubis' hand, and the restoration of a knife does not, in my opinion, represent the original state of the papyrus. Facsimile 2 is a drawing of an Egyptian funerary amulet known as a hypocephalus, which was placed under the head of the mummy and was intended to protect the head of the deceased, provide him with the sun's life-giving warmth, and to make it possible for him to join the sun god Re in his celestial boat, and thereby ensure his continued pleasant existence in the next life. Hypocephaly first occurred in Egypt during the late period and continued in use throughout the Ptolemaic and Roman period. The interpretation of facsimile 2 poses more of a challenge to Egyptologists and therefore is more fruitful ground for those seeking to justify Joseph Smith's interpretations in this facsimile. The challenge arises from the fact that many of the figures in the hypocephalus are not labeled and can only be identified through citing parallel illustrations and allusions in other texts. In interpreting the figures in the hypocephalus, Egyptologists rely on the fact that the image of the hypocephalus represents the rising from the Duat, the rebirth of the deceased with the sun, and the scenes are rich illustrations of chapter 162 of the Book of the Dead. Concerning Joseph Smith's interpretations of the figures in this facsimile, it has been stated that his explanations are in general, reasonable in light of modern Egyptological knowledge. The question is, reasonable to whom? For example, figure 5 is identified by Joseph Smith as Enish Go'ondosh. I have no idea where that comes from. Okay. And I don't think anyone else does at this point. Which he claims is said by the Egyptians to be the sun. Okay. Figure 5, upside down.
This figure is actually a depiction of the celestial cow goddess known as Ikhetweret, or Mekhetweret, the great flood, another cow goddess, or the goddess Hathor. Now, Varga has identified this figure as the most important in the hypocephalus. These goddesses were thought of as the mother of Re, the sun god, with Mekhetweret representing the flood from which he arises daily. It is important to note that while this figure is associated with the sun, the mother of the sun god, it is never equated with the sun. The sun is always a masculine deity in Egyptian religion. Joseph Smith's interpretation might be judged close by some, but in my opinion, it cannot be judged as generally correct. As another example of the attempt to justify Joseph's interpretations of the figures in this facsimile, note figure 4, okay, which has been claimed to be an instance in which the prophet hits it right on the mark. The explanation given in the Book of Abraham notes that this figure answers to the Hebrew word rakiyang, signifying expanse, or firmament of the heavens, and also a numerical figure in the Egyptian signifying 1,000.
This is 4.
It must be admitted that the certain identification of this figure is not possible with the information currently available to Egyptologists. Varga originally identified the figure as the god Sokar, but later resorted to the more vague description of the mummy of a falcon with outspread wings. The problem is that this figure does not match exactly the iconography of any known falcon god, i.e. mummiform with outspread wings. Let's see how this came out. One suggestion is that this figure is to be identified with the falcon who rises from the Duat in the Book of the Dead spell number 71. That's the falcon over there. Now, what's interesting is that this cow here is the same cow that we just looked at in facsimile 2, number 5. That's up there, Mekhetweret. So they're placed together in this spell. That could be coincidence. I don't know if there's any significance to that or not. But it is interesting. And this falcon is also said to be he who rises from the Duat, the underworld, which fits in well with the context of facsimile 2. But this is only speculation based on parallels. Even though this figure cannot be identified with certainty, an interpretation can be proffered based on context. Vargan notes that this figure symbolizes the entry into the beyond, the falcon spreading his wings from the mummy wrappings. When attempting to evaluate the correctness of Joseph's explanation of the figure, it should be noted that there is no evidence that the ancient Egyptians ever depicted the sky, which he refers to the firmament of the heavens, as a ship of any sort. In order to get around this, apologists dissect the wings of the bird in the ship and compare them with depictions of the sky as outspread wings. Rhodes identifies the bird in figure 4 as Horus Sokar and claims that Horus was a personification of the sky. It should be pointed out, however, that Joseph's interpretation of the figure apparently applies to the whole figure and not to only a part of it. Also, the statement that Horus personified the sky is not strictly correct, the sky having been conceived of as feminine by the Egyptians. As I just said, the sky kind of gave birth to the sun, so the sky was feminine in order to be able to accomplish that. I can see no justification for removing a part of the figure and then claiming to find interpretations which can be forced to agree with Joseph's explanations. In order to support Joseph's identification of this figure as the number 1,000, reference is made to a supposed Egyptian ship of 1,000, found in a passage from a sarcophagus dating to the Egyptian 26th dynasty. There we find the expression, Wea ef en ha ertep wifi, which Sander Hansen renders as his ship of 1,000 up to its two heads or between its two ends. In Sander Hansen's discussion of the passage, he notes that he understands this phrase to mean a ship of 1,000 cubits in length. This text is a later version of Book of the Dead 136a. Recent translators have recognized that ha in this phrase does not refer to the number 1,000, but to the word ha meaning flowers or buds. T.G. Allen, in his translation of the Book of the Dead, renders the phrase as the bark with blossoms at its ends, and Faulkner, in his translation, renders it as the bark which has lotus flowers on its ends. In connection with this spell, Milton notes that lotus-shaped prows are very common in various vignettes. And here's an example. A boat with lotus-shaped prows. That's what
this is.
The lotus flowers. Okay. In other words, there is no Egyptian ship of 1,000, only a ship with lotus-shaped prows. And all this is quite beside the point. Joseph, in his explanation of the figure in the facsimile, said that it was also a numerical figure in Egyptian signifying 1,000. It was not. There is no evidence that any ship was ever used as a numerical figure to represent 1,000, which is what this represents for the Egyptians, or any other number. It should also be noted that of those who wish to equate the figure from the facsimile with the so-called ship of 1,000, none has ever produced an image of this ship and then compared it to the facsimile. It's simply assumed that if a ship of 1,000 can be found somewhere in the Egyptian text, it must be the one Joseph Smith was talking about. Now, if you were going to look for a ship of 1,000, the best place to look would be in the scene illustrating the text in which that reference occurs. Okay, now, this is the vignette from such a spell 136A, in which the supposed ship of 1,000, which is really a ship with lotus bud prows, occurs. This is roughly contemporary with Joseph Smith of Papyri, thought to be. I mean, this is anytime from Sayite to Ptolemaic times. But here, what do we find?
Lotus-shaped prows, right there. And what's going on in the boat bears no resemblance to our figure 4, I believe, that we were talking about.
One area in which the field of Egyptology aids in our understanding of the nature of the Book of Abraham is that of its authorship. On one hand, it has been claimed that the Book of Abraham is an actual Abraham holograph. Recently, Paul Hoskinson has stated that the contents of the Book of Abraham did not pass through numerous revisions, the hands of countless scribes. It purports to be a rendering of an ancient document originally composed by Abraham himself, and as such, he maintains that the Book of Abraham cannot contain anachronisms, i.e. things that could not have occurred during Abraham's lifetime. Others have argued that while the contents of the text might in some way go back to Abraham, Abraham himself was not the author of the text of the Book of Abraham as it now stands in the Pearl of Great Price. In view of the fact that the heading of the Book of Abraham in the current edition of the Pearl of Great Price states that the text represents the writings of Abraham written by his own hand upon papyrus, I believe it's fair to state that most church members would believe that the Book of Abraham is a result of a translation of a direct Abraham holograph. I took a poll in my priesthood quorum last time I taught just to find out what people thought that meant, and it was generally unanimous. They all thought that this was something directly written by Abraham. I guess you could argue they're all out to lunch, but that seems to be the way they understood the phrase. One way to judge whether or not the Book of Abraham derives from an Abraham holograph is by whether or not the text of the book contains anachronisms. Of course, the first thing that has to be determined is when Abraham lived. The answer to this question is by no means simple, and scholarly estimates for the age of the patriarchs range from 2200 to 1200 BC. just in case you're interested, if you were just to go by internal Bible chronology, Abraham left for Canaan in 2091 B.C. Others would argue that while it is not possible to assign a date to the lifetime of Abraham, it is possible to situate chronologically the so-called patriarchal age. Many scholars would place this sometime during the first half of the second millennium, i.e. 2000 to 1500 B.C., while others would narrow the time frame within this period. In our search for anachronisms, it would be safe to say that anything occurring after 1500 B.C. is definitely anachronistic to Abraham's lifetime. And since Abraham is portrayed as the first patriarch, anything occurring at the end of this period is probably anachronistic. What then are the anachronisms which I believe can be identified in the Book of Abraham? Firstly, the association of facsimile 1 with the Book of Abraham cannot derive from Abraham, since facsimile 1 dates to approximately 100 B.C. There are passages in the text of the Book of Abraham which are attributed to Abraham and which refer to facsimile 1. The most straightforward reading of these passages would indicate that Abraham himself was responsible for the association of facsimile 1 with his own attempted sacrifice. The book opens with Abraham speaking in the first person, I, Abraham, and there is no reason to think that the I in verse 12, where we read, I will refer you to the representation at the commencement of this record, should refer to anyone except Abraham. These passages would then be anachronistic to Abraham's day. Secondly, there are several proper nouns in the text of the Book of Abraham which also postdate Abraham. I will consider them in the order of their occurrence in the text. The first such term, Chaldea, occurs in Abraham 1:1 and subsequently verses 8, 13, 20, 23, 29, 30, and 2-4, and 2-4. The Chaldeans were a people who spoke a West Semitic language similar to Aramaic and who appeared in the 9th century B.C. in the land south of Babylonia and appear to have migrated from Syria. Westerman has noted that the city of Ur could be qualified as the, I guess Westerman has noted that the city of Ur could be qualified as Ur of the Chaldees only from the 10th to the 6th centuries, in any case not before the first millennium. The second anachronistic word we encounter in the text is Pharaoh. In Abraham 1:6 we find Pharaoh, king of Egypt. In Abraham 1:20 we are told that Pharaoh signifies king by royal blood. There is one passage in which the term is treated as a name rather than as a title. In Abraham 1:25 we read, the first government of Egypt was established by Pharaoh, the eldest son of Egyptus, the daughter of Ham. The Egyptian word Pharaoh derives from an Egyptian term for the king's palace, which was called the Per'a'a, the great house. This term is not attested as a title for the ruler of Egypt until 1504 B.C., during the reign of Thutmose III, but was probably used as such earlier in the 18th dynasty, which began in 1560 B.C. It has been suggested that Pharaoh was simply Joseph's method of translation for a word meaning king, and that the word never actually occurred in the text. I would reiterate that in Abraham 1:25, Pharaoh appears to be used as a proper noun. That Joseph Smith considered Pharaoh to be an individual's name is apparent from his explanation of facsimile 3, figure 2, where we read, King Pharaoh, whose name is given in the characters above his head. The next anachronistic word encountered is the name of the place of the attempted sacrifice of Abraham, which is called Potiphar's Hill. Potiphar is the Hebrew form of the Egyptian name Padi-Pare, which means the one whom Re, the sun god, has given. The name occurs in two forms in the Old Testament, as Potiphar, the name of the Egyptian who bought Joseph, and as Potipharah, the priest of On, who is Joseph's father-in-law. Names of the form Padi plus a divine name are common in Egypt, but are first attested during the 10th century B.C. The only occurrence of the Egyptian equivalent of Potiphar is found on Cairo Stele 65444, which dates to the Egyptian 21st dynasty, 1069 to 945 B.C. The final anachronistic name in the Book of Abraham is Egyptus. In Abraham 1:23 we read, the land of Egypt being first discovered by a woman, who is the daughter of Ham and the daughter of Egyptus, which in Chaldean signifies Egypt, which signifies that which is forbidden. Firstly, Egyptus is not a Chaldean word, but Greek, and certainly does not mean forbidden in any language. The Greek Egyptus apparently derives from Egyptian Hut-Ka Ptah, the house of the Ka Ptah, which was the name of a temple of Ptah in Memphis. During the New Kingdom, this term came to designate the town of Memphis, the capital of Egypt, in which the temple was located. There is some evidence that forms of this name were being used by foreigners to refer to the country of Egypt. It is attested in the Mycenaean Lineage B tablet from Knossos, which is usually dated to around 1375 B.C., i.e. 125 years after the latest possible date for Abraham, as a man's name, presupposing that it was already a name for Egypt. Note also that the text implies that Egypt derived its name from an eponymous ancestor, Egyptus. Given the facts concerning the origin of the word Egyptus, however, this cannot represent historical reality. From the foregoing discussion, it would appear that, if one accepts a date of sometime in the first half of the second millennium for Abraham, then there are four anachronistic names in the text: Chaldea, Potiphar, Egyptus, and probably Pharaoh. Pharaoh squeaks in there at the end. If you want to put Abraham in the very, very last possible period that you could squeeze him into, you might be able to get him in there under the wire for Abraham. So that one's a probably. Since these are names, it is not likely that they are translation equivalents of other words in the original text. And if they are translation equivalents, they don't carry much meaning for us because they don't increase our understanding of the text. They're certainly not good translation equivalents if they are such. I don't believe them to have been. I believe that there is sufficient evidence of anachronisms in the text of the Book of Abraham to conclude that it cannot be an actual Abraham holograph, i.e. that it was not written by Abraham's own hand upon papyrus. One of the primary events of the Book of Abraham is the attempted sacrifice of Abraham. We are told that in the land of the Chaldeans, the god of Pharaoh, which apparently should be taken to mean the god Pharaoh, was worshipped. There was even a priesthood dedicated to the worship of Pharaoh, and this priesthood offered sacrifices to him. We are told that a thank offering was offered consisting of a child, and that three virgins were killed on the sacrificial altar because they would not bow down to worship gods of wood or stone. Finally, the priest of Pharaoh attempted to sacrifice Abraham, at which point the Lord intervened and rescued Abraham and destroyed the altar and the priest. From this we can infer several things. Apparently, Pharaoh and several other Egyptian deities were being worshipped in Chaldea. We are not told specifically that the other gods were Egyptian, but we are told that the worship practices were after the manner of the Egyptians, and the images which are said to represent these gods are Egyptian. We can therefore plausibly infer that they were Egyptian deities. Part of the worship of these gods involved human sacrifice. The religion of that time and place was intolerant. Anyone choosing not to engage in these worship practices ran the risk of losing his or her life. These practices seem to have been endorsed or promoted, or at least encouraged, by the Egyptian pharaoh. We are told that at the death of the priest who attempted to sacrifice Abraham, there was great mourning in the court of Pharaoh. The first thing we have to ask ourselves is to what extent were Egyptian worship practices introduced into Asia? If one accepts that Ur of the Chaldees refers to Tel Mukayar in southern Mesopotamia, then from the start the text must be judged historically erroneous, because the Egyptians never had a strong cultural influence on Mesopotamia. There have been attempts to locate Abraham's Ur near Haran. This area is also outside of Egypt's sphere of influence, even at the height of its empire. In order to evaluate the verisimilitude of the account found in the Book of Abraham, we have to examine Egypt's religious policy toward its Asiatic empire, which first came into existence during the New Kingdom. The results of such a study indicate that Egyptian gods were only rarely worshipped on Asiatic soil, and then exceptionally. Rather than introducing Egyptian gods into Asia, the most common occurrence was for Egyptians stationed at posts and garrisons in Palestine to adopt the worship of the local Asiatic gods. Stefan Wimmer has recently written that the Egyptians never thought about forcing the local population of Syria-Palestine to forsake their gods in exchange for Egyptian ones. Donald Redford states that the Egyptians forced no one to accept Egyptian ways. Concerning the Egyptians' religious tolerance, Yaroslav Cherny has written, "Egyptians were tolerant to each other within Egypt itself and were equally tolerant to the gods of a conquered country. Towards the native gods, they behaved as they so often did in Egypt toward the gods or goddess of another town. They simply considered them as different names and forms of their own Egyptian deities. It is clear that in these circumstances, no heresy could arise, and with the exception of a short period under and immediately after Akhenaten, nothing is known of religious persecution of any kind in Egypt. One could argue that it is the Chaldeans doing the persecuting, not the Egyptians. In response, it could be said that the Chaldeans had nothing to gain from forcing Egyptian worship practices on their people, since the Egyptians did not expect it. Further, there is no evidence that any Asiatic land ever became so thoroughly Egyptianized that they would have adopted such a zealous attitude toward the Egyptian pharaohs on their own. Remember, they're worshiping Pharaoh. If I remember correctly, they even offer a child to Pharaoh. There's no evidence that anyone outside of Egypt, and even within Egypt, cared that much about the pharaoh. Again, Redford has noted that we have no evidence that these official Egyptian cults exerted a serious attraction on the local population of Canaan. Blyberg maintains that in Palestine, traces of the state religion of Egypt can be found. These traces, however, are restricted to the Ramesside period, 1295 to 1069 BC. Their influence is superficial. So it appeared that in the area over which they had direct control, and at the height of Egypt's imperial power in Syria-Palestine, the Egyptians made no effort to introduce their religion to their subject peoples, and they in turn exhibited little interest in the gods of their conquerors. It is therefore extremely unlikely that any of the areas suggested for the location of Ur would ever have adopted Egyptian religious practices to the extent called for in the Book of Abraham. In the preceding, I have argued that, 1, Joseph Smith's interpretations of the facsimiles are not in agreement with the meanings which these figures had in their original funerary context. 2, anachronisms in the text of the book make it impossible that it was translated from a text written by Abraham himself. And 3, what we know about the relationship between Egypt and Asia renders the account of the attempted sacrifice of Abraham extremely implausible. Those of you who have stayed with me to this point will have noticed that much of my argument is one of science. i.e. that at present there is no evidence to support Joseph's interpretations of the figures, an earlier date of occurrence for some of the terms that I mentioned, and the interest in Egyptian religion found in Mesopotamia, wherever Ur of the Chaldees is thought to be. However unlikely I may think the possibility of such evidence ever coming to light is, I cannot state that such evidence is not forthcoming. Okay, I don't know what they're going to find next week, next year, next month in Egypt. I can only say that at present, the available information that we have does not support Joseph Smith's interpretation of this material. I believe it is also important to point out that none of the above has any bearing on the antiquity of the Book of Abraham, but only on its historicity and authorship. Just because a text has been determined to be unhistorical does not mean it cannot be ancient. There is much in the Hebrew Bible that is not historical but is still ancient. There have been arguments made that the Book of Abraham should be seen as Jewish Hellenistic pseudepigrapha, and that the introduction of the facsimiles into the text was done by someone uninterested in the original purpose and function of the scenes. There are also arguments that the Book of Abraham is a 19th century text, which Joseph Smith produced under the influence of Revelation. Each of these arguments has its merits, and what I have presented here today does not serve to support or refute either position. It should be noted, however, that if one accepts that Joseph Smith was using the facsimiles in a fashion which was not consonant with their original purpose, it does not make sense to then insist that the prophet's explanations of each of the facsimiles accord with present understanding of Egyptian religious practices. I see no evidence that Joseph Smith had a correct conception of Egyptian religious practices. I see no reason to have expected him to have had such a conception, and I do see no reason that such a knowledge would have been essential to the production of the Book of Abraham. Thank you.
Both a little perplexed and pleased that I was asked to respond to this paper. Perplexed because I am not an Egyptologist. I approach this paper in a way that, like I'd approach optics. I know nothing about optics, but I am interested in vision and the ability to see. I am pleased, though, to be able to respond to this paper in part because Brown University is also was where I did my undergraduate work. At the Religious Studies Department right around the corner from the Egyptology building. I'm also pleased to respond to this paper because of the solid work that Stephen Thompson has put forth in examining some of the claims that are made about the Book of Abraham, its authorship, and its interpretations. I want to underline also that he has set out for himself a very specific task, and that is to assess with the historical critical tools of the Egyptologists the claims that first Joseph Smith's explanation of the Book of Abraham papyri are congruent with present understandings of Egyptian religious practice. Second, that the text of the Book of Abraham is a holograph of the ancient patriarch. And finally, that a key scene in the text, the attempted sacrifice of Abraham, is historically plausible given our current knowledge of ancient Egyptian history and culture. Well, to each of these assertions, Steve Thompson has replied convincingly, I believe, in the negative. The three claims can be maintained only in ignorance of these arguments or in spite of the evidence by relying upon unsubstantiated claims, disregard for the original context of the composition of the text, anachronisms in the document, and historical inaccuracies present in the telling details of chronology and culture. I think something that this paper should has underlined for me and should underline for all of us is the value of knowing as best as possible whereof one speaks. But that kind of knowledge, the knowledge that one can acquire and speak of with some scholarly assurance, only comes with mastering the discipline, and also with paying the dues of apprenticeship, of acquiring that mastery of that discipline. And I think that we do ourselves, as a community, and as teachers, as students, a real disservice in seeking shortcuts in our apprenticeship, because our final product as craftspeople will be very flawed. A few comments on the paper in particular. even though Stephen Thompson is himself a contributor to the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, I'm not sure why he finds Michael Rhodes' assertion about Joseph Smith's knowledge of Egyptian religious practice as, quote, a truly remarkable statement. Now, I had the benefit of having the paper in front of me and knowing that he's responding to an article written by Michael Rhodes that was included in Volume 1 of the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, one of a series of articles dealing with the Book of Abraham. So he's responding to that article and to some of the statements, some of the assertions were made by Mr. Rhodes. But he must know that this massive compilation of Mormon scholarship is a creation of its times, of our times. And though a number of the articles, a substantial number of the articles, make significant scholarly contributions to our knowledge of Mormon history and of the Mormon community, the Encyclopedia's editor-in-chief was executive secretary of the Church's Correlation Committee and was working under the direction of two apostles of the Quorum of the Twelve. And it has been described, the encyclopedia has been described by one reviewer as a carefully sanitized partisan affair which omits, distorts, and compromises in order to advance and protect a positive image of Mormonism and the Church. If that assessment of that reviewer is correct, then the remarkable, I believe, it becomes much more commonplace. For the sake of maintenance of certain appearances, it becomes incumbent upon the commentator of the Book of Abraham to find a way to support the claim that it was written by Abraham's own hand upon papyrus and that Joseph Smith translated it from the papyrus. And I'm quoting directly from the superscription above the first chapter of the Book of Abraham. That's as it's printed in the LDS scripture. This approach, approach of a commentator is a finalist strategy of interpretation where the end is known in the beginning. The commentator knows in advance where he or she must go and what he or she must find. This is the way of mythology, of homiletics and rhetoric, not that of historical methodology. And I think that it was important for Dr. Thompson to notice, to acknowledge as much. He does not question that necessarily the antiquity of the Book of Abraham, but the historical bona fides of the text and of statements that are made, I think, occasionally rashly or with good intention about its historicity. But his discipline allows him only to do that much. That is to say, Egyptology is the study of Egyptian antiquities and of the Egyptian language and history. One who practices it, and I'm quoting from his paper, attempts to interpret Egyptian religious literature and iconography as he or she believes the ancient Egyptians themselves would have. But that bridge to arriving at that interpretation, the bridge to Viescovazenvar as things really were, is exceptionally circumspect. And it's probably one of the reasons why some of you may have had as much difficulty following his presentation as I did in reading it. Because to interpret the antiquities of Egypt, nothing is available to the Egyptologist as a historical scholar save the data relating to it. That is, the words, whether written or, you know, written words, the archaeological remains of past events and people to which and to whom the Egyptologist has no privileged access. That is, an Egyptologist has only the data at hand. He has no direct relationship via imagination available to him as it might be available to the writer of fiction, to some sort of a spiritual medium, or to a revelator or prophet or seer in some way. I think therein lies both the considerable strengths of this paper and also the shortcomings. I wanted to hear more about the Book of Abraham, and I'm wondering if Egyptology can offer us even more in terms of understanding the text. Perhaps it can't. Perhaps an Egyptology only allows us to make the kinds of judgments, very circumspect judgments that we heard this morning. Stephen Thompson's expert use of the tools of the Egyptologist may enable us to clear the air about certain misconceptions which adhere consciously or not to the text of the Book of Abraham. But in this paper, at least, they allow us to make no positive claims about the text and the context of its production. And so, you know, is that the sum of the relationship entitled in this paper, Egypt and the Book of Abraham? Can it give us no more than that? And I wish I could hear, you know, you sort of dilate on that a bit. Also, though, a couple of other comments, and that is you quoted James Breasted's statement that, quote, Joseph Smith very clearly demonstrates that he was totally unacquainted with the significance of these documents and absolutely ignorant of the simplest facts of Egyptian writing. I take that to be a little bit of early 20th century polemic. Breasted had a point to make. I think it was rather unscholarly statement to say totally and absolutely. The second half of that statement, though, in terms of Joseph Smith not knowing the simplest facts of Egyptian writing, may well be true. I'm unconvinced, however, that Joseph Smith was totally unacquainted with the significance of the documents that he held in his hands in the 1830s and early 1840s. The reason why I say that, among other reasons, is at the same time that Mormons in Kirtland, Ohio, purchased, treasured, and tried to understand the papyri and the mummies that had come into their possession, British commercial vessels carried thousands of mummified corpses in their cargo holds, plundered for the tombs of Egypt. The destination of these bodies, once carefully prepared for their journey into the afterlife, thousands of years ago, that the destination for those corpses were the mills of England, where they were ground down into powder and sold to farmers and gardeners for bone meal. 77 years before Professor Breasted's judgment about Joseph Smith's competence and judging the significance of the documents in front of him, he brought to bear to the papyrus, to the papyri and to the mummies, the tools that were at his disposal to attempt to parse out the meaning of these antiquities. Now, they were not the tools of the professional Egyptologist. I mean, we all have to acknowledge that and grant him that. But what strikes me about this episode is what Joseph Smith called their joy. This is quoting from the second volume of the History of the Church, the joy of the saints in Kirtland, that they had discovered a value in these mummies and in the papyri greater than a soil supplement, but rather in these ancient figures and glyphs, Joseph Smith discerned, quote, that the Lord is beginning to reveal an abundance of peace and truth. It's true that given the methodological criteria of Egyptology, we can see no evidence that Joseph Smith had a correct conception of Egyptian religious practice. And yet at the same time, I find Joseph Smith's misconception congruent with those same religious practices. That is to say, it's possible that given Joseph Smith's orientation to the transcendent, to his belief in the immortality of the soul, of its final judgment, and of the possibility of, quote, achieving a blessed state in the hereafter, end quote, that Joseph Smith was at least as aware of the significance of the Egyptian funerary text in his hands in Kirtland in 1835 as are those who are ready to pronounce judgment upon his competence. There are a number of other things I don't want to go on too much longer. No other things I'd want to say about this episode, but most of what I would have to say obviously comes out of a perspective that's not informed by the discipline of Egyptology. And in all fairness to Dr. Thompson, it would take, you know, would be comments that would go beyond what his paper attempted to establish. One thing, though, I just in closing would want to say that you know, what could be more significant? Again, talking about the significance of the papyrus, what could be more significant to the Egyptian for whom this papyrus was prepared and with whom it was buried, than as Dr. Thompson mentions, the successful transition of an individual to the life upon his death, end quote. That last journey of the soul, of the lone voyager, fraught with perils and challenges to face and overcome on the way to the throne of an awesome judge, is depicted powerfully in Egyptian funerary literature. It was buried with the deceased, and this funerary text, as I understand from your paper, served as a sort of passport and guide to achieving a blessed state in the hereafter. Now, I think that the papyrus served in some sense in analogous ways. I'm sure that the person who was prepared for burial and with whom this Book of Breathings was entombed had been instructed beforehand what the purpose of his life or her life was about, where this person had come from, the origin of existence, and where, hopefully, this person would end up, what would be his or her blessed state if they could account well for their individual life here upon this earth. It seems to me that in many ways, the Mormon community construes the book of Abraham in much the same way, that is a book which enables us to have some kind of understanding of our origins, of the purpose of this life, and of its ultimate meaning and destiny. And so I would ask us to consider Joseph Smith's work in trying to understand the Book of Abraham with a great deal of generosity, perhaps more generosity than Professor Breasted was able to extend to him. But also, I hope that you can, with me also, extend our congratulations and our thanks to Dr. Thompson for an excellent and very, very well-informed paper. And again, I want to underline how important it is for us to seek out tools, the scholarly tools in the discipline, to be able to pronounce a considered judgment on this work. Thanks very much.
We have about 5 minutes before they probably want us to move on out of here. Are there any questions that you would want to pose to either a presenter or the respondent?
Any questions? Could I say something to that, though? I'm glad you mentioned that, because I've been told the tone of this paper is pretty harsh, and I've been through it a zillion times trying to take that out, and I'm not sure where it's coming from. You're right, I'm not trying to denigrate Joseph Smith at all. I still consider him a prophet. I'm only looking at his product from one point of view, not from his context, right? It's another entirely different way to look at, and as you pointed out, in his own environment, how does his product relate to what he had available, what he could have been expected to know? I'm reacting more to claims that have been made for others on his work later, and there seems to be a school of thought that Joseph Smith knew everything in the world there was to know about the ancient world, that somehow he had this spiritual knowledge. I mean, he walked and talked with Nephites, he had, you know, all of this stuff, and Joseph Smith just knew it. And he never made those claims that I'm aware. He never claimed to be an Egyptologist, to know everything there was to know about Egyptian religion. I think he claimed to know a little bit about it. We have some, you know, he gave tours and showed the papyri off. How much of that was showmanship and how much of that was revealed knowledge, I don't know. But I think that some of my tone is more directed against claims that have been made for him later, for which he is not responsible, than for his own approach and attitude to papyri. It's just debated what he thought the papyri were. Some have claimed, I mean, everyone knows, I assume everyone's familiar with all the issues that surround the Kirtland Egyptian papers. I mean, that's hotly debated. And I can't say anything about them because until last night, I had not seen good photographs of them. So I'm completely unable to comment on that. So I tried to stick to just what Egyptology tells us. And Egyptology is limited. I mean, you're right. We can't read the ancient Egyptians' minds. We can just do the best we can now. And but I think others claim that what Egyptology does now supports Joseph Smith, and they manipulate the evidence that the Egyptologist has to those conclusions. And I think that's unfair and unfortunate. That was the point of my paper. I don't know if it came out. Yes, sir.
Your last, a mummy that is animated in that way?
Okay, now when you say pictures, like there are pictures where the figure on the bier has the legs up like that. There are other pictures. Nibley includes some in his old improvement era articles back in, what, 67, 68 from Filey, I think. Now, they're not exactly like that. So that's what I say when I say like that. I don't mean that everything else is identical. The figure on the bier has both legs up. One hand, in some instances, is before his face. One hand is under him. So there are differences in their similarities. But to the specific question, are there figures with two legs up? Yes, there are.
But they're interpreted
as definitely being mummies? No, actually, that's not a mummy. I don't think I ever said that. As he was undergoing the process of mummification. He might have already achieved it and be in the process of resurrection. I mean, that's the whole point of mummification, is to be involved in revivifying the body. He's not a mummy by any stretch there. He's not mummified and wrapped up. It can be argued that he's in the process of regaining his life. He's being resurrected. I don't know. But there are other examples of the two legs being up. But no, if I gave the impression that I thought he was a mummy in that condition, no, I did not mean to do that. That's not correct. Whoops. As I said before, at present, there are no good photographs published of that material that I have access to. And I cannot comment on it with any degree of confidence because of that. I would dearly like to be able to see that material better and have good studies of it available. They're just not there. A few pictures published in BYU Studies by Nibley. I think maybe a few more pictures in that book by Larson, by his own hands, upon papyrus. But the entire collection, as far as I'm aware, has not appeared in photograph. There's Xeroxes out there that are of questionable quality. I think, once again, so you don't have the photographs to compare them to. I don't know. Maybe they're great. I've looked at the Xeroxes, and I don't see enough there for me to be able to comment on it. So, no. That's I just avoid that whole issue entirely until I can speak with some semblance of unauthority.
Well, our time is gone. Thank you, our presenters. Let's give them another round. Thank you.